Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hello and welcome to Press Gazette's Journalism Matters podcast. My name is Freddie Mayhew, editor of Press Gazette, and today I'm joined by Matt Kelly, editor of The New European. Thanks for joining me, Matt.
You're most welcome.
So, Matt, you're also chief content officer at regional newspaper publisher Archant.
Newspapers and magazines, yeah.
Newspapers and magazines, right. which owns and funds and pays for The New European.
The New European is owned by Archant.
It's owned by Archant. Because I see sometimes you get accused of getting money from other places. It's all Archant.
Well, I think there's sort of conspiracy is that it's funded by Tony Blair or George Soros or the European Commission, and I wish, but it isn't. It is purely run on the revenue we get from circulation. Yeah. You know, we get very little advertising as well, which I wouldn't mind talking about. But it's purely, almost exclusively circulation revenue, and we take no funding from anybody, any third party at all. So I'm happy to put that rumour to bed.
Put it on the record.
Yeah.
So what is the advertising situation? How come you aren't bringing in stuff from advertising?
The advertising thing, I think, is a symptom of how we, or a consequence of how we launched it. We launched it as a temporary thing. We said it was going to be around for 4 weeks. Obviously, quite a niche, specialised audience and quite politically polarised. So, you know, I don't blame advertisers for saying, well, if you're only going to be around for 4 weeks, then what's the point of paying any attention to it? But we're now in week 103, you know, and for about the last 18 months, we've been trying to get noticed and saying, you know, we've got this a remarkably good audience. You know, we've got 23,000 people every week paying for the paper, really passionate about it, very good demographic, AB and wealthy, you know, and all of the good things. But it is remarkably difficult for a new product to get any traction in the agency world. If you haven't got the huge scale, they're not interested. And if there's something a little bit edgy about you, or you're in a corner somewhere, then they think to themselves, why should we bother selling this to our clients, you know, the advertisers? So it's been a real uphill battle, and that's the part of the P&L that has been a struggle. The thing that hasn't been a struggle is the circulation revenue, you know, which fortunately, because we're so expensive, relatively expensive, £2.50 for, you know, what is a standard newspaper, no magazines, no supplements or anything. So with that £2.50, we can more or less cover our costs. Some week we lose a couple of hundred quid, some weeks we make a couple of hundred quid. But it's kind of break even. If we had advertising, then it would be a very interesting business. And I think the advertising will come eventually. So that's what we're hanging on in.
I sometimes see you tweeting the Today Show for not including you in their roundup. Do you feel sort of a bit snubbed by the mainstream, or are you?
I learned early on in my tabloid career that if people weren't sort of talking about you, then you weren't at the races. So I'm very keen always to look for a viable argument to have with somebody. So if picking a fight with the Today programme, it helps me get that argument and get that attention, then fantastic. And also, I think we've got a valid point. You know, we've had about two mentions on the Today programme. The Spectator gets mentioned every week, the New Statesman every week. Why not the New European? You know, we're selling almost as many as the New Statesman now after just 2 years of life. So, you know, we should be taken seriously, I think.
And why do you think it is? Is it sort of a Brexit bias for the BBC, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. I think they see... I think they are slow to wake up to the fact that we are a serious, good newspaper and we've got, you know, a remarkably high calibre of writers for us. I don't think they read the newspapers themselves, you know. I think they read the Daily Mail, the Sun and... you know, a passing glimpse at The Guardian, perhaps, but that's probably it. And, you know, getting them to pay attention, to take notice of what is a very kind of particular point of view, but on this huge issue, is very difficult, you know.
Although, to be fair to the BBC, they do always get criticised from the other side as well.
Yeah, but there's a bit of a... So they use that as a defence. They say, well, if both sides are slagging us off, we must be doing something right. Now, I would take issue with that. I say that... both sides may be slagging the BBC off, but for very different reasons. I think the right wing criticise the BBC because they have learned for many, many years that bullying them works. And the left wing criticise them because they're not getting the airplay that the right wing are getting. So I think it's entirely plausible that you can be criticised by both sides and not be doing very well as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And part of the reason we are talking today is because, as you mentioned, you have now published more than 100 editions.
Yeah.
Which is quite a remarkable feat, given, yeah, as you said, it was only intended for a four-week run. It came straight hot off the heels of the Brexit referendum vote.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you were proudly the newspaper for the 48%, yeah, of Remain voters, which is still the tagline, isn't it?
More or less.
But, I mean, how does that feel? I mean, that is a publishing success by any market, in this current climate.
I think you're right. I think, you know, if it all collapsed tomorrow... we'd still be able to stand back and say that was an extraordinary 2 years. You know, we've sold more than 2 million newspapers over those 2 years. We've won all sorts of awards. You know, I mean, from a team point of view, the prestige that the New European has given Archant, I think, is significant. You know, it put Archant on the map in a lot of people's eyes. Mm. I think my hope is that we'll carry on for a longer period of time, maybe even become, you know, as sustainable as those other titles, The Statesman and The Specky. But, you know, whatever happens, I think we've done a great job with the product. Even if people hate the politics, and there's plenty who do hate it, we get very few people saying it's a bad newspaper. And we don't get any people in the industry saying it's a bad newspaper, because it's patently not. It's a good newspaper. And for me as a journalist, that's the most proud element of this whole story, is that this very small team at Archant was able, as you say, you know, within 9 days, to be able to produce, market, distribute a brand new national newspaper with no budget, and to have it still 2 years later on sale and successful. I can't think of another newspaper group that could pull that off apart from Archant.
And with your revenue from circulation, you're what, breaking even roughly?
More or less. Like I say, some weeks we lose a couple of hundred quid, some, yeah, like it is incredibly frustrating. I mean, when you think about it, it's entirely happenstance that the circulation revenue is an almost exact fit for the cost base. And if it only sold 3,000 more copies a week, then we'd be totally relaxed. But every week I have this kind of huge anxiety moment on the Monday afternoon when I find the circulation figures. And if it's slightly north, then that's great. We've made some money. If it's slightly south, then we lost some money. But, you know, it's not in jeopardy as things stand. So we're still building it.
And it's about, up to sort of 20,000, isn't
22
it?
22 to 23,000. I mean, that's literally the kind of...
every week.
...balance. But it's, you know, I spent 18 years on the Daily Mirror, and you would get excited by a circulation move of 1%, you know. Our circulation swings by 15, 20% some weeks.
Yeah.
And it just depends on, you know, if we've done a great job with the cover, if Brexit's a hot topic... And if I happen to be on radio or Alistair Campbell's doing some publicity for it or whatever, then we'll have a great sale. But if all of those things don't happen, we can be 20% down week on week, which anybody trying to build a newspaper business, I think, will appreciate just how massively stressful that is. So anyway, I live with a permanent fingers crossed, you know.
Yeah. And it's £2 an issue, isn't it?
£2.50. So we went. What was interesting about that, just in case there's any sort of newspaper nerds in the house, we went up from. We are certainly in the right place for that. We went up from £2 to £2.50 at the beginning of the year and braced ourselves for a sharp decline in circulation, but nothing. So I think it's very interesting that if you've got your product right and the audience really care about you and they're passionate, the price point is not the main thing. And I actually wish we'd charge, you know, £3, £4 for it when we launched, because I don't think our audience care that much about how much it is. What they care about is that it exists, you know, and they love the fact that this thing arrives every week and it reminds them that there is a body of people who think like they do. And that's worth more than £2.50 to them. So we're building the subscription base. That's the big important thing.
That's gone up, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So we're up with more than 8,000 subscribers now.
And I think when we spoke about a year ago, when you just hit the year mark, that was about 5,500.
Yeah, so it's growing steadily. And that's incredibly gratifying. And the churn rate, the people who are dropping off each week or month, is the lowest in our group out of all the magazines and all the newspapers we've got. So again, it speaks to that idea that if you are genuinely true to an audience, the audience is genuinely true to you.
I guess one of the questions is, I mean, in the time that you've been publishing, we have seen a couple of national titles struggle to get off the ground and then ultimately fail. New Day.
Yeah.
24 in the North, CN Group.
Yeah.
Why do you think you've succeeded where others have failed?
So, I mean, the chronology, just to get that right, is that those two titles you mentioned had failed before we launched the New European, which makes Jeff Henry's decision to press on and launch the New European.
That's Archon Chief.
My boss, Jeff, Chief Exec of Archon. You know, he's the guy that said, yes, you know, let's do this. And in the context of two big groups having sunk a huge amount of money in new newspaper launches very recently, I think that was a remarkably courageous decision to take. So big thanks to him. Why did we succeed? I think if you compare the audiences we're talking to, the New Day, okay, and the audience, as I recall, it was, you know, it's a new type of reader who's fallen out of love with the traditional newspapers and they're looking for something fresh and speaking in their language. 24, the paper for the North, right? Who the hell knows whether you're a New Day reader or not? Or if you're in the North? I mean, to talk about the North, I'm from Liverpool, right? Don't equate me with someone from Leeds or worse, Manchester. And Manchester and Liverpool are 30 miles apart, you know. And no way would we think that, you know, there's a commonality there. So I think that concept was flawed. But if you ask yourself who knows whether they're a new European reader, it's absolutely obvious. If you're one of the 48%, then you're a new European reader, or you're certainly in our market. So the great insight I think that we had, which has sustained us through to today, was that on the morning after the referendum, there was this huge new constituency of people who didn't know they existed 24 hours ago, but suddenly they were one of the 48%.
Yeah. And you had a market.
And they were angry and pissed off, and they were all unified by this common theme. So I think that's why we did really well to get in really quickly and just seize on that emotion, you know.
Is that still your readership, you think? Are they still those sort of ardent Remainers?
Yeah. Hardcore Remainers.
Because it's quite a strong Remain stance than you.
Yeah.
It's not sort of no two ways about
no,
it.
No, no.
I mean, it's a bad thing.
100%. In fact, I think that's our USP. That's our reason for being in the marketplace. And every time I kind of stray away from that because I feel, wouldn't it be nice to be a bit broader, you know? And also there's this weird thing with progressive liberal journalists that they feel the need to balance, you know. You don't get the Daily Mail feeling the urge to balance stuff, you know, but, you know, the Guardian, the Mirror, you know, let's present both sides. Every time I do that, I get slapped in the face by the readers, you know. I mean, cancelled subscriptions. We had Aaron Banks writing a column for us for 3 weeks.
I remember that, yeah.
Because I thought, that, well, look, you know, our readers are really smart, they're intelligent. Banks is the absolute polar end of the spectrum. And so let's hear what he's got to say. You know, and if you don't like it, turn the page. And the response we got was, I don't want to see that man soiling my new European. And so it was very clear to me that the new European was a sacred space for a lot of people, and that I shouldn't let people like Aaron Banks piss in the water of the new European.
One of the things, it certainly has an identity as a newspaper, and I think that's quite clear. And you mentioned it earlier, the front pages can sort of turn your sales around, I guess, boost them or otherwise. Where did that sort of come from, that idea to, you know, really go for a... It's not traditional newspaper front page where you lead with your big story or whatever. Yeah. But how did that sort of come about? Why did you make that decision?
So I wanted it to be distinctive on the newsstand. I didn't want it to look like the rest of the dailies, because we've got weird... There's weird things about the New European. It comes out on a Thursday. It stays on sale all week. It's not a periodical. It doesn't sit with the New Statesman. It sits with the national newspapers. So it was essential for me that it looked distinctive, right? And at the time, I was really into the covers of Charlie Hebdo, the French satirical magazine, which had these very kind of binary coloured cartoons. Obviously, that got them into loads of trouble. But the look of them, you know, and the sort of... The idea that you could have a very cheeky, fun thing on your front page but be very serious inside was really appealed to me, you know. And I remember going to Jeff, actually, and saying... He said, what's the cover going to be like? And I said, I'm going to do something like Charlie Hebdo. And he literally went pale. And he said, I don't want to be attacking Muslims. That's not good. I said, no, I just mean we're going to put a cartoon on page one. So that was a big sigh of relief. And I think ever since then, we've wanted to... Don't forget, the other thing is we've got no marketing budget. So all of the attention we get is either me gobbing off on radio or TV, or the stuff we get on Twitter and Facebook. And nothing goes more viral than a funny cover on Twitter, so we get a lot of airplay from that.
And that hasn't changed. No money sort of for the marketing from Arch and...
small amounts. So we market the marketing tends to be... the money tends to be invested in the discounts we give to new subscribers to convince people to subscribe. And people often ask, readers often ask, what's the best thing, you know, should I buy it every week or should I subscribe? And the answer is subscribe, because the yield we get from people over a long period of time is much, much greater, because people do drop in and out. It's funny, people do like to go to the newsagent and literally go through the ceremony of buying it, you know, and handing the money over. And a lot of people read it and then leave it somewhere public, you know, like a waiting room.
Sort of small protest.
Yeah, just like to try and pass the word a bit, you know, some kind of sinister subterfuge. Yeah.
It's a brand to be seen out and about with for your readers.
Well, I mean, that was genuinely the single most important thought in my head when we were talking about should it be a website or a newspaper. And I was very clear from day one that it should be a newspaper, because I want... If you think about it, there's very few ways of visibly demonstrating who you are these days, you know. If you're a Remainer, what do? You can go on a march, you can wear a badge, or you can carry a copy of the New European. And I wanted it to be one of those things that people held with pride, you know. Like I used to, with the Independent, when I was a pretentious 16-year-old, and the Independent launched, and they had that great slogan, the Independent, it is or you. And to prove how independent I was, I did exactly what they told me to do, you know, and bought it. But I sort of tucked it under my arm, and I thought, look at me, how smart and independent I am. So I wanted people to have that same pride in the New European, to carry it around like a membership of a club.
What's it, when you're sort of putting the papers together each week, so you've obviously got another day job as well in your role at Archon.
Yeah.
And am I right in thinking you're sort of only staff member, as it were, on the New European?
Is
Jasper Copping?
Jasper Copping, yeah. He's ex-Daily Telegraph. He's a Norfolk lad, so he came back to the EDP and he was working on the EDP.
Eastern Daily Press.
Eastern Daily Press, which is our main daily. It's the daily of Norfolk, really. And so Jasper happened to be the guy that was put forward as the help for these 4 weeks. And I've been so lucky with him because, and the great thing about it is Jasper is incredibly modest and hates being talked about, so it's a great joy to be able to do this. But he is such a pro. So he's like production editor, features editor, news editor, effectively deputy editor. You know, he sits there and he pulls all the stuff together. And so my job is commissioning, having ideas, you know, moving ideas from Alistair Campbell, who's full of them, to Jasper, and, you know, and then going through on a Tuesday, which is the day before we go to press. We go to press on a Wednesday morning, so Tuesday's really the big day. And I spend a fair amount of time on Tuesday going through the design, the production, because I'm a production journalist by background. But it works really well, and we've got to that nice stage where we're a very small team, but we're all completely aligned. We all understand exactly what the paper's about. And in many ways, the paper feels like it's kind of editing itself, mostly, you know. And we're just sort of fulfilling the opportunity.
So we'll talk about Alistair Campbell a bit, yeah, and his involvement, because he's editor at large.
Yes, he is, yeah.
But just tell me, you're coming out on Thursdays. What stage in the week are you thinking about the front page and having that impact? And is that sort of, aside from the commissioning, is that sort of your main focus, getting that impactful front page?
Yeah, so when I was on the Mirror, I used to be night editor at the Daily Mirror with Piers Morgan, who, whatever anybody thinks or says about him, is a brilliant tabloid editor, right? He turned the Daily Mirror around from being a lazy, torpid, second-best thing to the Sun. And then for a period of years, I believe we were the best tabloid in the marketplace by a margin. And what always struck me about Piers was that in the morning, he was really busy obsessing about the news lists and the features list. But from about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, all he really cared about was what was the front page going to be. And, he had the confidence to let the guys get on with the rest of it. But his job was, what's the front page going to be? Because that's your chance, that's your marketing. As Kelvin McKenzie said, you know, the paper's best marketing is its front page. So to answer your question, I'm thinking about it from the weekend on. I'm trying to think what's the story of the week and how can we put an attention-grabbing spin on it. We don't always get it right. You know, funnily enough, we've got it out in front of us here. I went through on our 100th issue, I went through every single front page and gave a little note on how it happened, what it was like. And on some of them, I look at them and I go, oh, God, that sucks. You know, we really got that wrong. But we live and learn, you know, and we're getting better and better, I think, at understanding that it's got to be a bold message, it's got to be a bold headline, it's got to be a very simple. The more clever you get around trying to convey something, then the fewer people you convey it to. Because people don't stop and stare, you know, they give you a microsecond of their time.
Yeah, and certainly, as we've got in front of us here, the bloody idiot on the number 10 just after the general election is one of the most memorable.
Yeah, great. Pages. Well, I'm glad you like that because I can take full credit for that.
That was a Matt Kelly
original. Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, there's three or four of us who've come up with ideas for the covers, and in truth, most of them are you know, have input from all of us. Sometimes the cartoonist or the artists.
And who is that? Who is your cartoonist artist?
So we've got two guys both called Barker, Chris Barker and Gary Barker. They don't work for us, they're freelancers. Gary Barker does the cartoons on the cover, and Chris does a lot of the kind of concept ideas, the clever bits of Photoshop or the design. And Chris has got a great brain for magazine impact, you know. In fact, he was like the PPA magazine designer of the year last year, you know, so real talent. Chris, one week, will come up with a concept, I'll come up with a headline, or, you know, Chris will come up with everything, or Steve Anglesey will chip in with a great idea, and we'll develop it as a team. But Bloody Idiot was my idea, and well, I say that, actually, like all my ideas, it was nicked from somebody, and it was nicked from a slightly similar, and I actually can't remember what the topic was, but it was a US paper had done something similar with a kind of number within a headline that suddenly made sense. Right. And then I thought of 10 and then racked my brain for what word will... And then, of course, idiot came in. And then, don't forget, this was the day before. That paper was published literally the morning the results came in. So everybody the day before was anticipating that Theresa May was going to sweep the thing with it. So the original concept was bloody idiots and talking about the voters who'd just given Theresa May her landslide. And then, so when I thought this is turning, I thought it's better still, we just call her the bloody idiot. Yes, I think I've got a picture of it in a frame in my office, and I think it works really well.
Yeah, it certainly seems to chime with the novel.
Yeah. I remember Isabel Okeshott tweeting it, putting it up on the newsstand and taking a photo of it and just saying, I'm just going to leave this here, you know, putting it out on Twitter, so yeah.
And you also get, one of the other hallmarks of the New European is having such a wide roster of contributors.
Yeah.
Because you don't have reporters, do you? So you've got Jasper as your main guy, but it's none of the staff Archer is writing.
So the group political editor, Richard Porritt, does stuff for us each week as well. But, you know, like everybody else apart from Jasper, he has got responsibilities across the group. So the model is 99% contributors.
Yeah. You know? And how does it come about? You've got people like Bonnie Greer, Eddie Izzard, sorts of big names, and all the way through to Jonathan Friedland.
Yeah, Howard Jacobson, Alistair Campbell, big Yasmin Alibi Brown, you know. Yeah.
How does that come about? Are you sort of there sitting there hitting the phones trying to go, oh, do you want to write this? Or do people come to you? Because
Alistair came to us. Alistair came to us in the second week and he phoned us up. He didn't know who the hell we were. It happens that I had dealt with him at the Mirror as features editor of the Mirror when I was features editor there, but he'd forgotten all of that. But
when he was at number 10?
When he was at number 10. And of course, we were really anti the Iraq War, so we were at loggerheads with Blair and Campbell over that, seriously at loggerheads, and doing some amazingly violent front pages about what kind of war criminals they were and all of this stuff, blood on his hands and all. I mean, really vicious stuff.
So you got the full Alistair Campbell
stuff. So I've had Alistair Campbell in full kind of like, who the effing hell are you lot, and you know, you're so off beam and all of that. But in this instance, he phoned up and he said, who are you guys? And we said, well, we're, you know, new newspaper, blah, blah, blah. He said, well, I know that. What are you trying to do? I said, well, we're trying to stop Brexit. And he said, well, so am I. Can I get involved? And that was in time for the second issue. So we'd had Johnny Friedland write the splash on the first issue, and then we had Alistair Campbell write the splash for the second issue. So that was really important to me generally, that we had a very high calibre of people in the paper, because the last thing I wanted, I mean, almost personally, but also, of course, on behalf of Archie, the last thing I wanted was to produce something that was second-rate or embarrassing. You know, I was determined it was going to be great. So getting all these good writers is essential to me. I hit the phones. I've got a great contacts book because I was 6 years on the features desk of the Mirror. You know, knowing Howard Jacobson is very useful. You know, say, Howard, can you write us a great piece about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party? Set the agenda. Boom, off you go. Bonnie Greer, the same. Yasmin Alibi Brown, the same. And we've developed some really great talent, like Charlie Connolly, for instance, who's a guy that writes a lot of our feature stuff. Ian Walker, who's another freelance writer who isn't a massive name, but produces really great stuff. Sophia Du Bois. It's a blend of big names and up-and-comers, but the only prerequisite is that people can write really well. And the main reason for that is we've got no time to sub-copy. So we need copy to come in good and clean and not to need much work. So that's what drives the talent, really.
And they've all got to be Remainers, do they?
Or not necessarily. Well, yes, to some degree. Well, in God's honest truth, half of the paper is like a cultural thing, you know, Europhile. And I couldn't swear to you, hand on heart, that they're all Remainers. Don't know. I suspect they are.
Does it bother you?
No, not at all. I mean, my wife's not a Remainer, so if I can cope with that, I can tolerate all sorts of stuff.
But tell me a bit more about Alistair then. So he's approached you, he's made the first move there, and you sort of said, well, this is what we're about. We're about stopping Brexit.
Yeah.
I want to get on board.
Yeah.
What's his sort of, how does it work with him day to day? What's his involvement?
Sure. So, I mean, for the first 8 or 9 months, he was in and out. But he wouldn't write every week. Maybe he'd write once every 4 weeks or something like this. And I was, after a short period of time, I was saying, why don't you do a regular thing? And he was quite reluctant to commit to that because, you know, he's in huge demand. You know, he's got fingers in all sorts of pies, and he's doing motivational speaking, and he's advising governments in Albania. You know, I mean, incredible kind of array of demands on his time. But the one thing that has been consistent throughout it is the machine of ideas that, you know, he is, by his own admission, an obsessive. You know, so I will get literally on most weekdays 10 to 20 emails, comments about something we've written, or ideas about what we should write, or an intro to, you know, some extraordinary name that I don't know. And after a while, I said, mate, look, you know, you're doing so much work. Why don't you just come on board as editor-at-large? And he said, okay, I'll do it. And he is, you know, we had our 100th birthday party the other day at the National Liberal Club. In fact, I think you were there yourself.
I was there, yeah.
And as I said in my speech, you know, without Alistair, I don't think we could have kept on going. You know, he really is a driving force of the newspaper. And people have views on Alistair Campbell, obviously. And I still meet people, new European readers, who say, you know, why have you got that Campbell fella in, you know? Because of the Blair years, you know, and people have strong opinions about that. But I think Alistair's sincerity and the quality of his arguments make him a must read. And I think if Brexit ever gets overturned or anything like that, then not that he would ever take it, but he should be Sir Alistair Campbell, you know.
And what's he? Have you ever sort of been at loggerheads in what you're doing, or are you
once or twice? Yeah, so a couple of times Alistair said, you know, I think you've got that wrong, and I don't like that cover. Sometimes he's right, sometimes he's wrong. I would say I'm a better tabloid journalist than he is. He would argue with that, but anyway, I'm the guy that makes the final.
Is he salaried as a
Yes, he is, yeah. Yes, he is.
You're not going to say how much, though?
No, I'm not, but not, he's not on George Osborne money.
Right, yeah. Who is?
Yeah, exactly.
But tell us a bit about your time at the Mirror then, because it's a long time that you were at that newspaper. What was that experience like? You say working under Piers Morgan and Richard Wallace wasn't as well when he was editor.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
Brilliant. I mean, it feels like an age that's completely disappeared, those days of well-funded, well-staffed, well-resourced tabloid newspapers that could literally throw money at stuff, you know, and just be as good as they wanted to be. And I joined in 96. Colin Myler was just coming to the end of his editorship, and David Montgomery had poached Piers from the News of the World. And Piers arrived like a bomb going off, you know. And in truth, I think the Mirror had become, latterly, had become a sort of tired, slightly, you know, lazy paper. You know, it wasn't setting the agenda, it wasn't exciting, it was going through the motions. And Piers came in and just ripped it all up, you know, and suddenly we were all on our best game, or you were out, you know.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
So, and I was a young guy. One of the biggest advantages I had was that I was quite proficient on a Macintosh, and it was also at the cusp of that period where the artists were becoming, you know, literally redundant. You know, the guys that would sit next to the night editors and literally draw out the page and then transfer it to the Mac. Well, suddenly journalists like me were doing all of those things. So when Princess Diana died, which was, you know, quite early on in Piers's time, I remember the week of her death, we produced so many pages and editions of the newspaper that circulation was so high that Off-Stone Times came crashing down, that we literally didn't have time for that process of a night editor telling an artist to. So everything, I remember Piers saying, right, just get Matt over here, get Mike over here, get Lloyd over here, you know, and you guys just do it. And that week was the reinvention of the mirrors, the way we produce newspapers. So I was very lucky to be around for that. And then, so I had 10 years with Piers. Brilliant, brilliant editor. I mean, genuinely, you know, exciting, noisy, brash. You know, I read a thing he wrote the other day where Murdoch said, you know, the trouble with Piers is his balls are bigger than his brains. And I think that's definitely true. And he'd admit that himself. But ballsy, you know, and really fun. A lot of fun. And then when Piers got fired over those Iraq photos, Richard took over. And Richard, very different character to Piers, but a really good guy and a really good editor. You know, a fella who just wanted to produce great newspapers and to do good things with the newspaper. And that was great. You know, I've always felt that journalism's a craft, right? And we all make our money from journalism. But there are some people in journalism who are lucky to do those things and also get to feel that they're doing something good as well and beneficial and positive. And that's not true, I don't think, of all of us, unfortunately. You know, I could name newsrooms where I think people take a lot of money because they don't feel that emotion. But on the Mirror, you always felt like you were doing a good thing. So after a while, Richard asked me to redesign the newspaper. And I'm hooked up with a Barcelona design agency called Casas & Associates, who I'd later go and work for full-time. And after I led the redesign of the Mirror, I then went to do the redesign of the website, and I never left digital from that point. And I ended up running the digital outfit for a while. And then Boston Consulting Group came in and did a kind of study on our future strategy and brought a guy in from AOL above me, called Chris Ellis, who's a friend of mine, a really good friend, but we had a really difficult year where I don't think I got Chris and I don't think he got me. I think I knew a lot more about telling stories than he did, and he knew a lot more about the science of digital than I did, and it was an uncomfortable... It could have been a great marriage, but it was a very uncomfortable marriage. So after about a year of that, I said to him, look, you know, if there's a chance of having an amicable parting of the ways, I'd bite your arm off. And he said, that's fine by me. So I left the Mirror and I joined this agency, Casas & Associates. And I spent about 18 months, 2 years in Argentina doing the digital transformation of the biggest newspaper in Argentina, a paper called Clarín. A newsroom of 650 people. And when I got there was about 30 who were digital. And when I left, there was about 30 who weren't. So that was and I've still got great, great friendships there in Argentina. We got pregnant, my wife and I got pregnant during that period. And so I had to come back and look for a UK job. And it was at the time when David Montgomery had just bought Local World and he was looking for a digital director. So I joined Monty there. That was sold to Trinity Mirror. Didn't want to go back to Trinity Mirror. And Jeff Henry came calling and said, would you like to come to Archant?
Yeah. And that was a couple of years ago now. When was that?
Yeah, that was December 2015. Right. So in December, it'll be 3 years.
And full disclosure, I was at Archant.
You're an Archant old boy, that's
and
right.
And I was briefly there while you were there.
That's right. But, was it my arrival that convinced you?
Yeah, that's it. Walked straight out there. But you did, at Archant, while you have made big changes while at Archant,
yeah.
We did have the audience first strategy, didn't we? In November 2016, which you sort of brought in. And that was a lot of redundancies there, so more than 50 redundancies.
Yeah. Well, no, there were 50 positions put at risk, but there weren't that many redundancies. There were a lot of new roles. Yes, that's right.
But the news editor roles and the sub roles basically went.
Well, there's a one of the good things that I inherited at Archant was a newspaper production unit who were a very talented bunch of people, good designers, good processors of pages. And my general view on newspapers right now, national or local, is that, you know, the printed format is yesterday's format. I mean, put the New European to one side, but by and large, the printed format is the format in decline, right? But it's also the format that makes you the most money. So the challenge is, how do you find a way to produce the printed format as efficiently as possible, but also give yourself as much possibility and scope and resource to do the new format, which is digital and other channels, you know, voice and all sorts of other opportunities. And so anything that can make the newspaper process more efficient is a good thing in my book. Now, obviously, that's contentious, and you know, lots of people don't agree with me. Lots of people disliked very much the view I had taken on minimising the effort to produce the newspapers. But ultimately, I have to create the strategy that I think will give Archant the best chance of making it through, you know.
And in your eyes, is print sort of on a terminal decline?
Well, whether it's terminal or not, I don't know. But it's almost...
But it's being managed in that way?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, magazines, for instance, some of our magazines are in growth. The New European is in growth. Some of our weekly titles are turning round, and they're not in growth, but they're coming round. And we've got some very interesting projects in little pockets of the country, which are not digital strategies or print strategies, but audience-first strategies, and we are seeing significant uplifts in newspaper sales, not just digital traffic. But when we approach a community in a particular way, and we stop thinking of ourselves as this kind of one-directional broadcaster channel, you know, just throwing content at people, but we invite people in and make them much more of a part and try and give them a sense of emotional investment in that title, we are seeing growth across every channel, including newspaper sales. Yeah. So although, you know, if you ask me to put my hand on my heart and say, you know, in 25 years, will newspapers be the core revenue for local news groups like Archant or Trinity or Johnston Press?
Yeah, I am asking. Go on.
The answer is no, plainly. If we haven't made the transition to significant digital revenues within 10 years, you know, displacing print as the main source of revenue, we're in a lot of trouble.
So digital needs to become the
of course it does. Of course it does. You know.
And when, what about this sort of threat from Facebook and Google on that, and then taking the money away where you would ordinarily think that's where you'd be able to get it from, online advertising, that sort of thing?
Yeah.
Where do you sort of see that, and how? What do you see the remedy being?
So this campaign you guys have got, you know.
Yeah. So we've got the duopoly campaign.
The duopoly thing. So
Facebook and Google, basically, you're not paying enough back. Can you please pay more? You're relying on content as news publishers.
Yes. So, I mean, it's an interesting week for that, isn't it? Because we've had the copyright law in the European Union rejected.
That's right.
I thought that was a good thing. I have to say, this point of view is counter to our official point of view, and it's counter to the NMA's point of view. I think the idea of taxing Google for links on Google News is just stupid. You know, if you want to get more tax from Google, fine. You know, get the government to tax them properly as a business. Get the government to invest in community journalism. You know, so we got the BBC paying for local democracy reporters. So that principle of there's a set of content that newspapers can really no longer afford to cover, but it should be covered because it's in the public interest, so the BBC will pay for it. Well, you could equally apply that to court reporting, to council reporting. These are all things that are, by and large, unprofitable for newspapers to do, but are of great public service. So, you know, Lady Cairncross's review, I hope, will start to think about what other areas of this public service should the government support. So you could support that through greater tax revenues from Google as a very profitable corporation. But to say to Google, we're going to financially penalise you for being the ultimate user of the fabric of the internet, which is sharing. And don't forget, Google drives huge amounts of traffic to us as products and has given us greater reach than ever before. Mm-hmm. I think is just Well, I think it's stupid, but even if you thought it was a good idea, I mean, it's never going to happen, because what would Google do? If they'd shut it off. And how do we know that? Because they've done it. They did it in Spain. You know, Spain had a domestic law equivalent to this link tax, and Google just said, okay, there's no money in Google News for us, so we'll just turn it off. And the Spanish publishers are crying now. They did the same thing in Germany, but they were a bit cleverer because they made it optional. In Spain, it's compulsory. In Germany, it was an option, and most of the newspaper groups have gone back to the old system. So, you know, I think you've just got to accept the status quo and make your model around the reality of how people use the internet.
So probably a government levy and then that repay it in. Well, back in is to publishers is sort of the...
Yeah, well, whether it's a levy or not, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't object to that.
Yeah.
But or whether it's just saying, you know, I'm sorry, you are paying far too little tax, Google, Amazon, you know, Facebook in the UK. You can't just keep shipping all your profits back to either Dublin or to Sacramento. Or
but again, the government would take that money and
yeah.
give it back.
Yeah, that's what I think. Because, I mean, the government has said they're going to look for ways to support this important public service that local newspapers do.
So that's right. We're expecting recommendations from the Care Cost Review, so we'll have to wait and see.
Can I pull you guys up on one thing that I also think? This word duopoly.
Mm.
So I don't object to people thinking that Facebook and Google are both villains of the piece, but I do object to tying them together and looking at them as though they're the same thing, because they are incredibly different, and their motives are different, their business is different, the way they influence publishers is entirely different. And so I just think we do ourselves a disservice every time we label them as the duopoly, like they're one thing. You know, they're not. You've got to tackle each of them very differently, I think.
Google has certainly made that point to us.
Yeah.
You don't, as a journalist, have some sort of hesitation in having a government, you know, being funded by the government in some way, you know, if there was to be a levy?
Well, not really. I mean, the BBC is funded by a tax, effectively, and is a highly independent and totally autocratic organisation. So I don't think there would be any strings attached. I just think, you know, if the government said, here's money and this is what we are giving you the money for, then, you know, if you didn't, then if you then went and spent it on 27 great kebab restaurants in Swindon, then obviously that would be bad. But if you are then able to cover courts and councils and do that public service without having too much of an eye on the budget, that just seems to be a completely positive thing.
And do you think there is a light at the end of the tunnel for print? We're not going to see it suddenly turn around and go back to the way it was, or are we?
No, not at all. Because, I mean, if only because there's so many other options for our attention. So, you know, I often like to say that we're not in the content business or even the audience business. We're in the relevance business, you know. And there's a direct correlation to the relevance that we can create in a marketplace and then are able to pass that relevance on to people who can't create relevance, i.e. advertisers. And if you look at the decline in commercial revenues over the last 10 years, it's almost exactly maps the decline of relevance of those products in newspaper sales. So we are becoming less relevant in a marketplace in that one channel. We can expect less from advertisers, naturally. So we're not going to have the advertising revenues that we enjoyed 10 years ago. Fact, you know, we're seeing key vertical categories, property, motoring, recruitment, we're seeing them being absolutely savaged, you know, not just by Google, but by other third parties. And in some ways, you know, you could argue that that's never going to come back. I personally think some of it could come back if we get our act together and we start thinking about the communities in a more sensible way. But without doubt, big chunks of that have gone and aren't coming back. So the cost base remains the same, more or less. You know, everyone's gone through periods of redundancies and stuff like this, and we've attacked the cost base, but it's still a huge lump of money that is in danger of being more than the revenues. So that's when I'm talking about the necessity, the absolute necessity to make that digital leap. That's what that's about, you know.
I think if you don't have the money, you don't have the money. But I guess there is the argument that if you're trimming staff and you're cutting away at newspapers, then you haven't got a chance of reviving them into, you know, and making them into a product that people want to read again.
Completely agree. And there is a balance. There's a balance, and that's my constant, you know, nightmare or, you know, anxiety is what is the balance? When do we go too far that we no longer have an opportunity to deliver? And, you know, I think I won't talk about Archon specifically, but you can look at newspapers across the country and point at newsrooms where it's gone too far. The newsroom, I started on a little paper called the Formby Times in 1988, right? Four people in this village.
How old were you then?
So I was about 18, 19, right. Yeah. So four people, news editor, and two cub reporters, in this little office in the middle of this...
One of which was you, one of the cub
reporters. Yeah. In this bustling little community, which now, by the way, is like Beverly Hills, because all the footballers live there, right? But in those days, it wasn't so much. And we were right in the village, and people would come and go, come in, place their adverts, tell us who was getting married, who just died. And we were at the heart of the community, right? And the paper was great. It was a weekly paid-for newspaper, and it sold about 5,000 copies a week. So it was profitable. And then Trinity Mirror decided what they could do is shut that office and move the journalists 12 miles down the road to Southport, where there was a bigger hub, and produce the Formby Times from there. And it sort of limped on a little bit like that, but survived more or less. And then they decided, actually, we can move some of those staff to Chester, you know, because production can happen over there. We'll have a couple of people in Southport and they can just phone in or call in. And you could see the relevance evaporating away. You had no presence, you had no people on the ground, you had no ability to understand what was happening. And the paper closed, right? No more Formby Times, gone. Shame, great shame. Now, when I moved to Archant, the Islington Gazette, right, the staff were based in Barking, 12 miles down the road, right? And there was this, I remember there was a story that Christmas, and a guy had gone missing, a young guy, very good looking guy, very striking face, and he was on every phone box and shop window, missing, have you seen this guy? And it was a tragic story because it turned out he'd killed himself and he was found in this park. And the Islington Tribune, which is a terrific weekly newspaper run by, you know, the Camden guys, the Independents, Paul Foote's kid, I think, runs it. So I shouldn't say kid, he's probably older than me. But anyway, terrific newspaper, much more in touch with the community. They had the story, but the Islington Gazette didn't. Now, you could not miss that story if you were in the community. But if you're down the road embarking, you know, you're going to miss it all the time. So I am an absolute believer, literally having to have guys in the community who know the community, who care for the community, who do all of those lovely old-fashioned things like make the contact, go to the pub, speak to the landlord, find out what's going on, go to the court and look which room has got 20 people in it, you know, and follow the story. And if we don't do that, if we're all sitting behind desks remotely, going through press releases or looking on social media for stuff or just doing the calls, then we become completely irrelevant and we deserve to die. So that's my constant challenge is how do I balance that aspiration with the absolute reality that the cost base is constantly shrinking. Mm. But I hope my heart's in the right place.
I'll ask you to put your national hat back on now.
Yes.
And just talk about, well, Brexit is obviously the thing that drives the new year bin. I think when we spoke on was pretty much exactly a year ago, I think, for your sort of first year in print, you told me then, and I'll quote you, if we're a stone in the shoe of Paul Dacre, then that's a worthwhile position for me.
Yeah. Now, we've not only were we a stone in the shoe, we've ousted him.
I was going to say, he's now on his way out.
Yeah. Who would have thought?
Mighty Paul Dacre is leaving at the end of this year. And we've also had a change of editor at the Daily Express. So
yes.
Hugh Whitter has been replaced.
That's right. By Gary Jones.
Gary Jones, yeah. after Trinity Mirror, now Reach, bought Express newspapers. Do you think, I mean, there was both those titles were such big, ardent Brexit campaigners
that
could be said to have helped swing the vote. Yeah. Do you think that's true?
I think the Daily Mail, no question.
Yeah.
I think the Express was talking in such a banal way to a very fixed audience that it was, you know, I mean, honestly, who cared what they said? You know, it was a weather forecast one day, or then it was some Princess Diana's ghost, or it was statins, you know, and then it was like evil remainers. Gary Jones, who I know and for disclosure worked with for a long time at the Mirror,
right,
overnight transformed that back into a real newspaper. And it showed you that all the guys who were labouring under this lazy editorship, and I'm sorry, Hugh Witto, I don't know you, but I thought your paper was terrible. All of those journalists have been liberated and are now producing a good, relevant newspaper. Paul Dacre, though, I think for the last 20 years, has been feeding personal bias into the minds of this notional Middle England. And when the referendum came around, it was almost like a Pavlov's dog, you know, operation. All he had to do was ring the bell. The bell was the word immigrants. And suddenly, you know, he could turn people against Europe. I do not regret Paul Dacre's passing. You know, I would say that his newspaper is brilliantly produced. You know, it is a superb product. There is not a newspaper in the market that is more tailored and honed for its audience. But I think latterly he'd started to lose the plot a bit. You know, I think all of this enemies of the people, crush the saboteurs, you know, the Theresa May sycophancy, and the whole idea that half of the country was essentially evil and twisted. I think Lord Rothermere must have been looking at that thinking, gosh, Paul's gone off the deep end here. And Geordie Gregg, who has edited a very sensible, high-quality, good Mail on Sunday and has a Remain bias, will come in and I think make it a probably much better newspaper, more sensible. It'll probably be a lot less angry. It'll probably be a lot less conspiratorial. It may be a lot less sensational in part, but it'll be, I think, a better newspaper. And newspapers make a difference in the country. You know, a bad newspaper can have a very bad influence in the country. And so I hope that turnaround will happen now.
But when you get up in the morning, do you look at the Mail and think, right, I've got to come back against that?
No, sometimes,
in the European context.
Sometimes, more often than is comfortable, the Mail's front page gives us something to really push back against. And we do it with great, I think, objectivity. You know, we've got Liz Gerrard, who's a former Times journalist, who is brilliant at doing the analysis on newspaper story counts, gender diversity within newspapers, front page treatments, and or you know, when they're attacking certain topics, how do they do it, the consistency they do it with, you know, and the kind of repetitive messaging that they put out over the readership. And we do it like that, rather than just saying Paul Dacre's a so-and-so, you know. We leave that to Alistair.
And on Brexit, could you ever see the day when the New European puts it to one side and maybe evolves as a newspaper, and it's always going to be something on in the back saying, oh, we wish that hadn't happened, but
yeah,
you might change this.
Well, you're working on the assumption that Brexit's going to happen, Freddie.
Not you going to.
I don't. I mean, we're recording this the day that they're all at Chequers having their bun fight. I mean, who knows what's going to happen this evening? Who knows what's going to happen next week? I always quote this... Someone once asked William Goldman, the great screenplay writer, what was the secret of Hollywood? And he said, the secret of Hollywood is that no one knows anything. And that, to me, is like politics right now. Who knows what's going to happen? But let's say you're right. Let's say Brexit does happen. I think it would be very difficult for us to make that transformation from what has been a single-issue paper, but is the core, the backbone of the paper, if people lose interest in that topic.
What do you think? We've had our run, we'll close.
If we ever get boring, we'll close. The last thing I want to do is get boring and just hang on for the sake of it. If we start hemorrhaging money, we'll close, no question. Someone will close it for me, you know. But I don't want to be... just producing a weekly paper by rote because we happen to have landed a stable audience who, you know, no one knows what it is anymore. I'd much sooner close that and do something more interesting. We did a great project called The New Feminist. Did you see that?
Yes.
So about, I think it was issue 98, and we got Caroline Criado Perez, who was the woman who campaigned for Millicent Fawcett's statue. And I had a very violent run-in with her on Twitter. She accused me of being sexist, and I said, well, come and edit the paper then if you're so smart. And she said, okay. So she did. She came in. She did an amazing job. And it was a really good commercial seller for us. It completely changed the way I think a lot of women saw newspapers. Suddenly, a lot of women looked at newspapers and realised that they were all totally male-dominated. Everything apart from this thing, because it was so distinctive. So I think that potentially there's a market there for a paper written by women, edited by women, cartooned by women, photographed by women, about women's topics, and sold exclusively to women. Why not? So maybe that's something we'll do in the future.
Is that something you think you're going to repeat? Because that was a one-off edition, was it, for the week?
Yeah.
Is that something that you might do again next year?
Well, maybe sooner. I don't know. You know, Caroline did such a great job with it. I mean, she's a natural. She's never done it before, but she commissioned some amazing people that I genuinely felt this is a problem for me because her paper's better than mine. But anyway, it went out and it got huge attention. People loved it, almost exclusively positive reaction. And, you know, it's one of the proudest things we've done.
Do you feel that the being a pop-up newspaper, as it was sort of described when you first launched, gives you this kind of flexibility that you wouldn't ordinarily have?
Totally.
If you want to do something, you can pretty much go for it.
So if say I got offered... there's only one job I've ever really wanted, right, in newspapers, and I'll never get it now. But at the time, you know, when I was on The Mirror, I wanted to be editor of The Mirror, right? But say I was offered the editorship of The Mirror, right? You would go in and you would inherit, like any newspaper or any established magazine, all of the backstory, all of everybody else's efforts and inputs and everything. I had none of that with The New European. It was just our thing. It was our thing, and there was no expectation of success. So every week, we just thought, let's have a go, you know, let's have a go at this. And, you know, we did this cover of Trump with the barcode of the newspaper on his upper lip, like Hitler's moustache. And we said, is Trump a fascist, right? There's no way I would have done that if I had just walked into a newspaper with a three-year P&L plan and, you know, the fear of getting it wrong and having a huge contention. But because...
P&L being?
Profit and loss. Right. So, you know, so the idea that your revenues and your costs are mapped out to the nth degree for the next 3 years and somebody, there's a crisis if you don't hit that number. There was none of that. So, I mean, there is a little bit more now, but at that time, we just thought, hell, let's just do it. And that was one of the great issues that got really talked about. I happened to be on Any Questions that week, and it was a big topic of conversation on Any Questions, and we sold buckets of papers. So I think there's a freedom that comes from not caring, and it's really hard, though, not to care in an industry where if you lose 2 or 3% of your readership, you get fired. And that's today's reality. So to sit there and just think, my God, I could get fired over this front page because it may offend a big chunk of my audience is that's a perilous position to be in.
And lastly, what are your plans going forward for the New European? What do you want to do with it that you still haven't? Where do you hope it will end up?
I just want to keep it interesting, keep going. Maybe it's not the right format. I don't know. Maybe it'll evolve into a different format.
What would you like to see it become?
Well, it's an absolute bugger to get out every week. You know, it's constant stress. So fortnightly might be good. But, of course, fortnightly, half the revenue, you know, presents its own challenges. The complaint we get is that there's too much to read in it and people don't have the time to read it. And I think if people cancel subscriptions, then it's that. It's just said, look, I love it, but I haven't read it for the last 3 weeks because it's just too much. So maybe a little bit less in it, more photographs in it, more photograph essays would be good. And I also think at the moment, we've hemmed ourselves in with so many regular columnists that we haven't got as much room as I would like to do different stuff. So maybe fewer regular columnists, you know. But that aside, for the moment, we just try to get the best paper out every week. Every single week for every 102 issues, I've walked away on the Wednesday morning after we've gone to press and said to myself, was that the best you could do? And every week I've said yes. So if I get a week where I say, do you know what, I could have done better, or that's a poor paper, I will fall into vast self-loathing and try to close the thing as soon as we can.
And on that note, we'll end.
Thank you.
Matt Kelly, thank you for joining me.
You're welcome.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.